It's that time again for Tex Talks BattleTech, your go-to source for angry, surly, whiskey-soaked BattleTech and MechWarrior lore. This time around, we're discussing a major historical event. Well, truth be told, it's not just going to be a historical event. It's going to be the historical event. The main show. The death of Star League, or more specifically, the Ameris coup, the Civil War, and its direct aftermath. This is the single biggest event in the setting by impact. Please do know it has taken tremendous time and extensive research to put all of this together and considering its overall importance on the setting as a whole. It's going to be a long talk. However, while there is a tremendous amount of information we have to cover, I may not be able to include every last minute detail. So these in turn may be subjects that I may elect to cover individually at a future point in time. So fret not, this series has a lot of ground to cover and we'll get to everything in the end. Lastly, before I go on, the editor and I have decided to split this into two portions as it is stupidly huge. The research for this episode required a solid month and a half of reading, note-taking, 13 drafts, and many pots of coffee. So, without further ado, get comfy. We're gonna talk history. As with all histories, we're going to do our best to start at the beginning. To properly frame our history in this story, let us begin mid to 26th century. July the 9th, 2571 stands as the official signing of the Star League Accords by Ian Cameron and the five major House Lords of the Inner Sphere. Keep in mind, this wasn't just an overnight development, as what we'd come to know as Star League had slowly emerged from the treaties of mutual understanding in defense signed between the Terran Hegemony, the Capellan Confederation, and the Free Worlds League nearly two decades before. By the late 2560s, the Lyran Commonwealth, Federated Suns, and Draconis Combine had also decided to buy in, no doubt interested in all of the mutual benefits cooperation brings. These five major houses elected Ian Cameron as First Lord, who in his wisdom immediately realized the need for a single-party defense apparatus, with the loyalty to Star League placed above any individual house. While Star League provided a single bureaucratic instrument to rule and coordinate a united human coalition of states, it needed something with actual teeth to keep the houses in line. Houses which often as much enjoyed the occasional mindless war against their neighbor because they were bored or frustrated. The military arm of Star League was established as the Star League Defense Forces, and from the inception they were laid out to be the greatest military force in human history. The Star League Defense Forces, or hereafter SLDF, were initially organized into multiple military commands spanning the entire Inner Sphere. Each regional command would be made up of troops from varying member states in attempt to, in theory, prevent blatant favoritism or, more likely, insurrection. Further, loyal hegemony divisions formed the core of each command region's structure. Noble in design and practical in doctrine, the Star League Defense Force was a multinational military command with loyalty to Star League above all. for 500 light years in all direction, the inner sphere was a single, cohesive government, defended by the biggest military ever assembled and supported by a vast and relatively efficient bureaucracy. The lords of the great houses bought into the notion of the SLDF for no other reason than it was power not in their opponents' hands. In theory, it was, for the first time, a military that served the purposes of all, for the defense of all, and potentially allowed house militias and private armies to be a vestigial development of a more ambitious time. The first ambitious order of political business for Star League was to bring the periphery into the League. The Inner Sphere had always eyed the periphery with a healthy dose of fear. After all, they'd long ago decided they wanted nothing to do with the Inner Sphere, and their fringe civilizations were a constant reminder that Star League's authority was not all-encompassing. Humanity has had a long history of eyeing those on the fringes of civilization as barbarians at the gate. And thus, Star League saw a military intervention as a necessary step to safeguard their borders and acquire new taxpayers. This campaign of reunification under Star League's control was largely a political move, as nothing quite brings allies together like good old-fashioned military adventurism. Further, it would prove, in fact, what had been theorized as far as the capabilities of the SLDF went. A titanic demonstration of Star League's defense apparatus would practically unify the Inner Sphere under one rule, but it would also serve as a key reminder to member states, Star League above all. Thus began what would later be called the Reunification Wars. Or, from the periphery perspective, oh god, the Inner Sphere is invading because they need something to do, holy shit, god help us. By 2596, the Outworlds Alliance, the Magistracy of Canopus, Rimworld's Republic, and Taurian Concordat were all brought to heed. These campaigns were not easy, as the periphery saw this for what it was, a military adventurism and a large government's need to absorb lesser entities at gunpoint. The periphery resisted as well they could, but they were not a single cohesive organized government like Star League. And as history will remind us, the strategy of divide and conquer works best against isolated civilizations with vastly different governments, cultures, and military capabilities. Despite, in many places, a judicious application of scorched earth defense, the periphery was conquered under the massed forces of the Inner Sphere. The vast industrial complexes of the Inner Sphere and the logistical capacity of Star League overwhelmed the scattered and utterly unprepared periphery states. The conquered periphery states were initially treated as occupied territories, forcibly undergoing extensive reconstruction and integration at their own great expense, before being given non-voting status as a Star League territory. The near destruction of their governments and catastrophic infrastructure damage was so extensive that even nearly 500 years later, some periphery states would be far below pre-unification war levels of prosperity and economic output. And while most of the periphery accepted their new rulers for the time being, with judicious jackbootery being the alternative, some would solemnly vow to never forget, and thus began to plan for the future. You see, the periphery has always had a very strong streak of independence, and by exercising its might, Star League had confirmed everything the periphery suspected about the Inner Sphere proper, that they were nothing more than conquerors intent on ruling by force alone. By flexing its immense military might, Star League had brought mankind under a single banner, a single government, a single bureaucracy, and all that entailed. By conquering the periphery, Star League's defense force had demonstrated the value of Star League to its member states. Through the 2600s, Star League kept the peace as best able. It kept unstable member states mostly placated, and through every available means kept disagreements and conflict more or less hidden. That in mind, incidents did occasionally happen, such as the Hidden Wars, but well, that is potentially a subject for another time. It is of note that by pouring enormous public funds toward research and development, it is during this era that new technologies further expanded the power and reach of Starlink, such as breakthroughs like the HPG network, which allowed for rapid communication over vast distances. The prime circuits of the Starlink Communications Net, or SLComNet, were laid at the heart of the Terran hegemony in this era, forming the hub of what would become an InterSphere-wide HPG network. For the first time in human history, mankind could shitpost across the light years with minimal effort. It was an enlightened era. With the power of FTL communication, the reach of Starlink extended more easily into the day-to-day bureaucracy of running an interstellar government. Further, international commerce flourished during this period as accurate information regarding market economies throughout the InterSphere assisted the vast growth of industries throughout Starlink. But FTL communication was only one tool in the arsenal of Starlink's vast bureaucracy. To further combat the threat of instability within Starlink, the SLDF was built up massively for the first time since the reunification wars. Breakthroughs in technology allowed for the rapid evolution of battle mech design, warship capabilities, and accordingly, force projection capabilities. With a strong policy toward Starlink First, the Royal Regiments of Starlink would receive massive technological upgrades and breakthrough technological advancements first, with new technologies reaching those house units sometimes as late as a decade later. House lords put up with this because none of them could gain access to favorable technologies before the other, and thus, the balance of power was maintained. As well, during this time, massive space defense systems were built up across the hegemony worlds, consisting of advanced drone battleships, enormous battle stations at jump points, and ground-based space defense batteries, all positioned to make assault into the heart of Starlink a theoretical impossibility. SLDF fleets were massively upgraded with the latest in awe-inspiring firepower and command and control technologies, allowing fleets to rapidly respond and counter any threat to the state with overwhelming firepower. Star League fortresses were built on hegemony worlds and later throughout the InterSphere to act as garrisons, research and development centers, command and control points, and weapons caches. Star League academies for science and military training were established to provide the very best education to an ever-expanding government. That's not to say there weren't challenges or problems. During this time, a second hidden war between Kirita and House Davion nearly spilled over into greater conflict. It was only put down when Starlink deployed 5 elite divisions to break it up. This heavy-handed force shocked the Great Houses as, before this point, Starlink was not something that openly visited its wrath upon member states. As far as the Great Houses saw it, Starlink was their tool and something to keep the periphery in line. Not something that could, or arguably should, check their ambitions. After all, they'd bought into the central government for their benefit, not to have their own ambitions checked by it. As well, in this era, the periphery was beginning to chafe under the yoke of Starlink. Some military observers began to report of military buildups in the periphery that could rival the SLDF if given enough time. At this point, the only notable periphery power that openly supported Starlink was the fantastically wealthy and massively powerful Rimworlds Republic. It is a fact that SLDF observers reported that the Rimworlds Republic forces were potentially, at this point as far as they could determine, 2 or 3 times their allowed mustered strength under SLDF charter. Some suggested that the Rimworlds Republic had been building a military and supporting industrial base for generations for the purposes of open war. Tragically, this warning went largely unheeded. By 2751, the Star League was long established as the de facto legitimate government of the Inner Sphere. Despite major and minor controversies and a few difficult challenges to its primacy as a ruling body, Star League endured by effectively maintaining the peace and equality between the great houses. In this era, it ran the banks, regulated trade, facilitated FTL communications, directed public and military research to further development of awe-inspiring and incredible technologies. And do not forget that on paper it had the most powerful military ever devised under the leadership of utterly brilliant military minds. Its schools and training centers were the envy of the great houses and private institutions. Star League offered the reality of peace and relative prosperity that had never been known prior or since in the Inner Sphere. The Star League had managed to even diminish the once burgeoning private armies of the great houses by placing ever-increasing funding and trust into the very able Star League defense forces while regulating and restricting the size of non-SLDF units. For a time, the balance of power was maintained and all was seemingly well. From the Rimworld Republic to the Terran hegemony, humanity coexisted in relative peace under one banner. For six generations, House Cameron had acted as First Lords and Protectors of Star League. For six generations, Star League had given humanity the nearest thing they'd ever gotten to a golden age. But if the Inner Sphere has any constant, it is this: we are our own worst enemy. In 2751, First Star Lord Simon Cameron had an accident. By accident, I mean an engineered accident that resulted in his untimely demise. Star League protocols dictated an immediate transfer of power, and so, with the death of First Lord Simon Cameron, the mantle of First Lord passed to his 8-year-old son, Richard, who would become the 6th and final First Lord of Star League in the Cameron dynasty. Richard Cameron was then only 8, and therefore the 5 House Lords exercised their authority to convene and appoint an official protector for the young man. This was not only to guide him to adulthood safely, but to instruct him in the finer points of rulership. After all, there was no weightier crown than the First Lord of Star League. As well, all oftentimes petty, the great lords of Star League were not fools, and they each knew that any dynasty is one mistake away from tyranny, madness, and ruin. Fearing destabilization of their own fortunes, the great lords unanimously decided to steer this next generation toward greatness and prosperity, for their own interests, if nothing else. To further that aim, they appointed the highly decorated, utterly brilliant Star League General Alexander Kerensky to serve as regent and protector. Though he had lost his father, the young First Lord found himself under the watchful eye, protection, and guidance of one of the most formidable minds the universe had ever seen. In the end, Kerensky would be far more important than anyone could ever imagine. As with any tragic drama, the road to ruin started with good intentions and miscalculation. When Richard Cameron came of age and no longer needed Kerensky, he tried ruling by his own hand. After a short time, young Richard Cameron was befriended by Stephan Amaris, provisionally the president, but in reality the absolute ruler of the Rimworld's Republic. And ever so carefully, through kindness, gifts, and flattery, and even renaming a planet to honor the First Lord, Stephan Amaris slowly wormed his way into young Richard Cameron's heart and confidence. Before long, this young noble had found a close, confident, and trusted advisor in Stephan Amaris. And ladies and gentlemen, the unchecked madness of Stephan Amaris would ruin everything. I mean, look at that face. That's Kublai Khan. That's Kublai Khan who's been kicked out of an all-you-can-eat buffet because unlimited crab legs is a theory and not a fact. That's a bib. That's not a shirt, that's a fucking bib. Just saying. So who in the hell was Stephan Amaris and why was he so goddamn important? Well, For the sake of this story, he's certainly dramatis personae, so let's dig into him for just a moment. Stefan Ameris hailed from the Rimworld's Republic, which was at that time a terrifically powerful periphery state. At its height, the Rimworld's Republic managed to control 248 systems and had a ridiculously powerful military, a military it had without pause been building for generations. The Ameris line had, for a good span of its history, been building the Rimworld's Republic into a military superpower through massive investment into its defense industries, military training academies, and industrial sectors. Through careful deflection of scrutiny, bribes, politicking, promises, and flattery, the Rimworld's Republic maintained this military buildup for the most part without pause and in relative secrecy. Through careful maneuvering, through kindness and flattery, through court intrigue, and through supporting the First Lord through governmental decrees and initiatives, Mr. Ameris crept all the way to the throne, all the while biding his time for what would come. Mr. Ameris had a plan, and needless to say, it was a master course in Inner Sphere Dickery 101. When Richard Cameron turned 18, he made the first official proclamation of any merit to history. Executive Order 156. Executive Order 156 was issued on February the 6th, 2762. Dictated by authority of the First Lord that all House armies, including private militaries, militias, and honor guards, must immediately disband or join Starleague's defense forces. In addition, the order made illegal and prohibited to possess any firearm larger than a laser rifle or more destructive than a grenade. The idea of this order was to make the Starleague Defense Force the sole military authority and assert Starleague as the primary power in all strategic considerations. The idea was to create no room for private ventures that would undermine the strength of the League and to place all might and trust in a single administrative body. The order was aimed to prevent further infighting, secret wars, and the recklessness of House ambition, but with a long-standing history of private armies, it would be a very difficult law to pass. This order was first reviewed by General Kerensky, who admired the noble idea, but immediately knew it was completely impossible to enforce. In the past, the great houses have been made to decrease substantial percentages of their private armies and place a great deal of trust in the SLDF, but they never disbanded their own troops completely. After all, each state as a signatory of the Starleague Charter was guaranteed the right to maintain their own militaries, to defend their own borders, and to see to their own security needs. Over Kerensky's objections and attempted guidance, the order was still pushed forward. When presented with Richard Cameron's arrogant executive order, the great lords of the Inner Sphere perceived it with nothing less than betrayal, anger, and outrage. This was precisely what the Inner Sphere House Lords had feared, an upstart who would try to curb their power or diminish their house. For they rightfully considered the order to be a flagrantly illegal power grab. They perceived the order as a direct threat to their sovereignty and decided to check the young Cameron's power before he got any ideas. Immediately, an emergency High Council meeting was called. The First Lords unanimously declared the proposed document an illegal instrument of government oppression. They rebuked the First Lord openly. They were furious at an overreaching, seemingly power-mad First Lord who was dabbling with their inherent rights and freedoms. Before the situation spiraled out of control, Kerensky stepped in to maintain the peace. Kerensky barely managed to defuse the situation by siding with the First Lords, stating that in direct principle, the document undermined, if not violated, his oath to defend Starleague and the uniqueness of each constituent member state. Richard Cameron, the now thoroughly embarrassed and publicly humiliated First Lord, managed to meekly countersign his own offer. This small act was the turning point. To note, Kerensky was trying his best. Kerensky was many things, but above all, he was dutiful. He knew his place. He served the state. His parents served the state. His loyalty was everything. His oaths to protect the Inner Sphere, the Star League, and the peace it brought were more important than power struggles or personal friendship. To Kerensky, it didn't matter if the First Lord was a friend or near family. To Kerensky, it didn't matter that he'd raised the child to adulthood. It didn't matter that Cameron was a peasant or a First Lord or a banker. It made no difference to Kerensky what walk of life Cameron was, for he saw duty to the state as everything, and accordingly, there was room for nothing else. And while most would see this simple disagreement on a political issue, this one act was absolutely critical. This pivotal moment marks the beginning of a series of mistakes that would end Star League in the fires of hell. From this moment onward, Richard turned towards Stefan Amaris' influence and his advice, as Kerensky stood as a reminder of what he couldn't or shouldn't do. Amaris, through and through, was very supportive. Amaris was a yes man. He was an enabler. Kerensky was a sour reminder to the limits of his power, his reach, and his ability. By refusing to side with First Lord Richard Cameron, Kerensky had pushed himself out of the First Lord's circle of trust. Kerensky was more or less exiled from the court by remembering the oath he had made to Star League above all. Ego being what it is, the First Lord could not simply accept being denied by the great lords of Star League. With Amaris' influence growing, the First Lord saw his place was to act, and soon he did. In magnificently foolish retaliation and urged on by Amaris, the First Lord Richard Cameron dissolved the High Council completely. Again, with Stefan Amaris being a very strong influence, Richard Cameron embraced the full power of the First Lord and began to rule with an iron fist. Richard Cameron issued the Taxation Edict of 2763, which significantly increased taxes across the Inner Sphere. And worse, the tax burden was not equal. The tax burden on the periphery was catastrophically higher. This was a problem, as it was a highly illegal act, and more importantly, a flagrant violation of the reunification treaties which held the Inner Sphere and the periphery together. Fearing the worst and with good memory of the Inner Sphere's previous military adventures into their realm, the periphery began to arm itself for a throwdown. The periphery knew full well how the Inner Sphere liked to throw its weight around, by first making unreasonable demands, and then acting on them. For the resistance groups rapidly forming across the periphery, intent on resisting Star League, they found that they had a new friend. Soon enough, the periphery was all too ready to fight Star League because of help from no other than Stefan Amaris. You see, Amaris had been planning for all of this. Amaris was playing both sides to further his own aims. Amaris had, after all, inherited a nation from a family hell-bent on building the biggest military in the periphery, and certainly more than many times the size of Great House for strength. Amaris had even used his friendship with the First Lord Richard Cameron to buy mothballed SLDF ships by the flotilla, boosting the Rimworld's Republic fleet to 270 warships, something that SLDF intelligence pointed out until people stopped listening. Stefan Amaris had even leveraged his nation-state's vast wealth to commission and launch battleships that were larger and better protected than Star League's best available. And he didn't stop there, folks. For the insane are, quite oftentimes, methodical. Convincing Richard Cameron the periphery needed development funds and investment from the gratuity of Star League's enormous coffers, Amaris applied for and gained access to endless government grants and untold sums that he doled out to the periphery states. With these extensive funds, he attracted all those who had felt the leash of Star League, from patriots keen on once again earning self-governance to the bitter dispossessed. Amaris supplied them all. With enormous funds came self-defense contractors from the Inner Sphere, who soon armed the periphery with the best weapons money could buy. With seemingly unlimited resources and access to powerful warfighting technologies, unrest in the periphery accelerated exponentially, requiring the eventual deployment of some 98 SLDF divisions into the greater periphery military region. the SLDF found itself spread thin, fighting terrorists, insurrection movements, and mired in a series of hit-and-run engagements against a sophisticated guerrilla movement, one adept at hiding in and fully supported by a civilian host population. Star League's defense force was well-equipped for open warfare, and in doctrine was the Hobbesian Leviathan Force, applied to an intense insurrectionist movement. The Star League Defense Force found itself incapable of gaining ground. It wasn't a military designed to be a police force, and without an opponent to match and overwhelm, it struggled. In addition, with the vast distances of the periphery to cover, the Star League's Defense Force found itself quickly overwhelmed by a population that wanted them gone at seemingly any cost. Meanwhile, Ameris, playing friendly as ever, offered General Kerensky information on terrorist groups operating in the Taurian Concordat, information that Kerensky dutifully acted on in the name of state security. When Kerensky found and captured a powerful Taurian insurrection group's leadership, he discovered that the group was in turn operating with the full blessing and support of the Taurian Concordat. This then resulted in Kerensky using the SLDF to tighten Star League's grip on an increasingly unruly periphery, which then increasingly saw the SLDF's military presence as the criminal occupation by tyrants. Every heavy-handed SLDF response to the rising militancy of the periphery emboldened more to resist. The periphery now saw the SLDF as the enemy of enemies, the instrument of oppression of a distant and unwelcome Star League. They firstly felt the abuse of massive taxation and then the massed presence of Star League forces as an obvious prelude to conquest and God knows what else. For the periphery, they had to resist or submit. The periphery being the periphery, the choice was easy. And soon enough, things boiled over catastrophically. In 1765, the 265th Star League Heavy Assault Regiment was annihilated by a nuclear device smuggled into their garrison. And things got worse from there. All hell broke loose with a new Vandenberg uprising. 17 worlds from the Taurian Concordat broke away in open rebellion. Kerensky immediately traveled to the front and tried to disarm the uprising without further blood being spilled. These were, after all, his countrymen, fellow citizens of Star League that he was sworn to protect. He ordered local militia units to stand down, to return home, and to not support further conflict. Local forces increasingly refused, supporting the independence movement or really anyone who was giving it to Star League, which inspired similar defiance across the periphery. After all, local units had stood up to the big bad government, which flinched instead of annihilating them outright. Kerensky's unwillingness to absolutely crush them out of compassion resulted in widespread perception in the periphery that Star League had gone soft. The uprising quickly spread through the periphery, the magistracy of Canopus and the Outworlds Alliance. Garrisoned SLDF units woke to find themselves surrounded by a very hostile and well-armed periphery. Some SLDF garrisons were attacked, some were functionally annihilated in well-coordinated attacks, while many others were surrounded and sieged by a civilian population tired of Star League oppression. A few even switched sides, deciding to join the periphery in an uprising, distributing their weapons and in turn becoming rebels themselves. The SLDF desperately tried to contain the spreading insurrection, but to no avail. The periphery was now willing to pay an enormous price to push Star League out and free themselves from their oppressors. Suicide attacks were the most common tactic of the early uprising and catastrophically effective. When a fueling vessel detonated inside the Star League battleship Nebraska, Kerensky saw, perhaps for the first time, the true strength of enemy resolve. They weren't interested in merely pushing garrisons off planets anymore. They were taking the fight to the SLDF wherever they were. What was initially sporadic suicide attacks and disorganized resistance blossomed into organized military resistance. From Ameris' military funding, the periphery raised some 50-odd regiments. Kerensky was facing an actual war and defended what he could. Kerensky nearly died as he took to the field to defend his headquarters, piloting an Atlas on New Vandenberg. This was beyond his worst fears. The Star League was now fighting its own citizens. Order was breaking down. This wasn't an insurrection or an isolated movement. This was a civil war, being spread horribly thin and surrounded by endless hostiles. Kerensky was rapidly losing territory and men, doing his best to suppress what was a substantial enemy dedicated towards seeing the SLDF fall. Star League Defense Force garrisons were cut off and unable to reinforce each other. Communications routinely failed. Sabotage and terrorism claimed warships, dropships, and jump ships. Governments concealed insurrectionist groups or disavowed them while funding them and at the same time wishing them luck. Kerensky was unwilling to use his full authority to crush the rebellion with maximum firepower. For total war against his fellow citizens, regardless of their Star League territorial status, was unthinkable. And with every victory, the periphery was emboldened. Soon enough, the periphery quickly became a lost cause, with more and more systems declaring Star League to be occupiers and tyrants. First Lord Richard Cameron called on all the great houses to assist the SLDF in putting down what he saw as an open rebellion to his just and honest rule. The great lords in turn all refused, because this dumb kid had disbanded the High Council while pouting over Executive Order 156. The great lords saw the tax edict as the direct cause of the rebellion and reasoned that it was the First Lord's problem. After all, their militaries were diminished and far too small to help anyways. That's what the SLDF was for, they reasoned. This was a Cameron problem, and they'd hold off jumping in until Cameron had solved it. Meanwhile, Kerensky begged for reinforcements from all points, trying his best to protect what he could. He ordered all SLDF units capable of transport to move at best possible speed to reinforce his tenuous hold on the periphery. The heart of Star League, the Terran hegemony, was emptied of its forces in a bid to reinforce Kerensky, leaving only skeleton crews to man defense stations and garrison those worlds. By mid-year 2765, there were barely 10 SLDF regiments left in the Terran hegemony. Everything else was locked in garrisons elsewhere, unable to transport, or refusing to leave their regional military district undefended. The SLDF never had to mobilize on this scale before, as this was an unthinkable nightmare scenario. The Great Lords had been greatly offended by First Lord Cameron, and now they were completely uncaring as to the fate of Star League under his control. Accordingly, each of the Great Houses adopted a sit-and-wait approach to this period of massive instability, offering token assistance to the SLDF through transportation to the front and nothing else. Many lords were quite content to watch this play out, defend their own holdings, and prepare to deal with the aftermath. Many predicted this would merely be the beginning. Unfortunately, they were very right. The war in the periphery had become a meat grinder the SLDF had not prepared for. By the end of 2765, the SLDF and the periphery were in dire condition. Cut off, surrounded, and refusing to surrender, the loyalist SLDF regiments found themselves snuffed out one at a time, often enough with overwhelming nuclear bombardment. 13 entire divisions were glassed by nuclear fire for refusing to surrender or to join the rebels. Pleas from cutoff units went unanswered as Kerensky was himself desperately holding on to rapidly disappearing friendly territory. All he could do was listen as his forces died for reasons they couldn't grasp. By the end of 2765, combat losses were so horrific in the periphery that half the SLDF units originally stationed there had to be disbanded, as they were utterly destroyed. They could not be reconstituted as any meaningful fighting force. By the end of 2765, Kerensky had decided to evacuate the periphery with the remnants of his task force. The general had no choice but to evacuate to the inner sphere and wait for reinforcements many months away. He had been sent into the periphery as a policing action and barely survived with his command intact. He was wise enough as a general to walk away, to reassess and reinforce, and to recuperate what he had. He was content to wait until the time was right. The periphery war was an engineered, unwinnable nightmare scenario, and Kerensky had the wisdom to see through parts of it. He waited patiently in the inner sphere, waited patiently to rebuild his forces with SLDF reinforcements from the hegemony and other military districts. As the surviving SLDF from the periphery uprising trickled in, his intelligence of the situation developed. He made plans to go back into the periphery, but only when the SLDF was ready. This would no longer be a police action. This was war. His plan was to reinforce first, replace losses, and bring up fresh manpower, then to systematically conquer the periphery, destroying the rebellion and restore Star League's rightful order. In the end, it would take until January of 2767, a year and some months of hard campaigning, to even gain the upper hand. The total cost of the periphery uprising and rebellion to the SLDF was, at the end of 2766 and beginning of 2767, 106 divisions and 61 independent combat regiments lost. Additionally, 61 divisions and 6 combat regiments had been rendered functionally inoperative and disbanded out of more or less compassion. As catastrophic as that sounds, as slack-jawed as your veteran friends are right now at those numbers, dark deeds unfolding in the hegemony would prove the periphery uprising and guerrilla war to be nothing than a horrible distraction and a prelude for the hell to come. Now, I have to wind back a bit and tell you about what had been transpiring in the hegemony as the periphery burned. You see, Ameris' fuckery was advanced. While the periphery complained, rebelled, and then openly warred against Star League, the Rimworld Republic had been surprisingly and exceptionally loyal. Their military rounded up and executed traitors to the League. Their military expelled attacks from the periphery. They had gone out of their way to be incredibly helpful to the needs of Star League, and as such they gained a most favored nation status with the First Lord Richard Cameron. This demonstrated loyalty and greatness allowed Ameris to engineer a deal with the young Richard Cameron the year before. Ameris and the Rimworld Republic had pledged his significant military forces to assist in the event of trouble. Trouble which was now certainly knocking on the door. By 2766, as stated, most of the Star League Defense Force was fighting an unending insurrection in the periphery. Most of the hegemony's outstanding garrisons had been emptied to feed necessary manpower and supplies to the war front. It is notable that even the bulk of House Cameron's own royal troops were diverted. As Richard trusted Ameris completely, the Rim World's Republic offered assistance in Star League's time of need was, well, universally accepted. After all, each of the House Lords had refused to help, so Richard Cameron accepted the help of his close friend and trusted confidant, Ameris. Through mass mobilization, the Rimworld Republic sent an enormous number of units to garrison the now abandoned posts throughout the hegemony. Some SLDF commanders obviously saw this as a problem and tried to raise alarm as they were able, but the signature of the First Lord pulled a lot of weight. These troops were loyal. Under Richard Cameron's blessing, the Rimworld Republic had free rein and total access to all SLDF defensive systems, totally integrating with the government and doing whatever they pleased, including gaining access to the Space Defense Network systems and the massive amount of armaments stockpiled throughout the hegemony. By 2766, half the damn Rimworld Republic military had been deployed to the center of the Inner Sphere. For every SLDF division that left to fight on the front, 2 Rimworld Republic divisions would arrive to reinforce the hegemony, the very heart of Star League. Rimworld's forces trained and drilled in Star League facilities and availed themselves of all the intelligence coming in from the front. In particular, they paid very close attention to the Star League Defense Force deployments and after-action reports. From this observation, they gained direct working knowledge of the SLDF, its order of battle, tactics, operational deployments, warfighting capacity, and accordingly, its weaknesses. Through integration into hegemony defense systems, they gained working knowledge of the space defense systems, the garrisons, and arm caches throughout the heart of the Inner Sphere. The armies of the Rimworld's Republic were perfectly poised for what would unfold. They took their time and prepared accordingly. With Kerensky far off fighting an insurrection and then open rebellion in the periphery and the Rimworld's military at his back, Stefan Ameris had decided it was well enough time to act.
After all, Ameris's life had led up to this very moment. Driven by his own insanity, his own ego, his own madness, and to avenged, imagined, perceived wrongdoing to his family, his destiny, and his house by House Cameron and Star League, Ameris had acted to undermine it all. From 2753 onward, he worked to befriend Cameron, saying yes when others said no, being friendly when others chastised, supporting him when others refused. From 2753 to 2766, Ameris had been the best friend of Richard Cameron, there for him in any capacity, and behind the scenes, he worked to destabilize Star League from within. He pushed for the tax reforms that would in turn drive the periphery insane, and before that, the edict to strip house lords of their power, abrogating many long-standing treaties in the process. He pushed the periphery to the boiling point and then ensured a determined and stubborn general was there to feed their worst fears and not back down. Through this all, Stefan Ameris built trust in the First Lord by always being the voice of kindness, friendship, and benevolence. And on December the 27th, 2766, Stefan Ameris took the final step of his plan.
Stefan Ameris had such an enormous amount of trust in the First Lord that he was allowed to walk into the audience chamber with his personal bodyguard and no one raised an eyebrow. After all, this was normal. Ameris was often seen doing what he pleased in the halls of power as he was a friend and trusted confidant of the First Lord. In fact, Ameris had brought a present, a gift in a carefully wrapped box. Richard Cameron accepted the gift like many others, finding underneath all that wrapping a jewel-encrusted, gilded, magnificent work of engineering, a laser pistol bearing the crest of Stefan Ameris, and in full view of all in attendance of the greater court. Stefan Ameris picked up the gun. He raised it to the light, showed how the jewels caught the sun and sparkled, and as First Lord Richard Cameron sat there staring at his prize, Stefan Ameris smiled and blew his fucking brains out. And that's how you get ahead in the Inner Sphere. But a coup isn't just the removal of the head of state, or, in this case, the head of state's head. No, the trick is to follow through. And Ameris was most certainly thorough. Over time, he'd managed to gain access to the palace's defense systems, as Richard Cameron had shown their operation in great detail to his best friend many a time. However, Stefan had himself a fucking problem. The goddamn Black Watch.
Let me tell you about the Black Watch. The Royal Black Watch, or 191st Royal Battle Mech Division, could trace its lineage back to ancient Scotland of Terra in 1725 as a volunteer militia for the purposes of keeping watch for crime. By the 28th century, they had significantly evolved. In the purest terms, the Black Watch was no joke. They were not a parade unit. They were not a propaganda piece to scare people into leaving the royal family alone, and they did not idly bask in their royal regiment status. They were the chosen protectors of House Cameron, and thus the first family of Star League. The Black Watch was not a bauble or a plaything. They were a ruthlessly loyal fighting force dedicated to their duty. They were a hardened group of warfighting experts given the finest equipment humanity could muster, along with the best training of any regiment in the Inner Sphere. In addition, each and every one of them were graduates of the Gunslinger program, which in Battletech is the equivalent of saying they're all pretty goddamn amazing at their job and have spent their entire military career in Special Forces level training just for instances like this. They had a single duty, which they took very seriously. That duty was to protect the royal family. The royal family, which Stefan had just decided to harm. when one of Stefan's idiot goons managed to trip an alarm in the throne room and get vaporized in the process, the Black Watch was alerted, activated, and immediately went into battle. That's not to say the Rimworld's Republic military hadn't planned to fight them. Ameris had been thorough. Ameris had ensured his best were armed and equipped for the task at hand. Ameris's elite forces had expended an enormous amount of time and effort to train for the purposes of taking Unity City, securing Ameris's person, and eliminating any remnant of the SLDF forces on the planet before the day was out. For months and months, they had brought equipment and personnel to the region and trained for this day. They knew in full the operation and workings of the SLDF, their garrison strengths, and battle plans. The coup required total suppression of all SLDF garrisons on Terra for this to work, and Ameris had reinforced his own forces to ensure total victory. Ameris' forces had in fact drawn up extensive plans to kill every last member of the Black Watch and trained exhaustively for a very long time to accomplish this singular mission with high efficiency. Unfortunately for them, though, the Black Watch was the stuff of legend. Immediately after the alarm was tripped, Ameris' goons almost lost their initiative as the first wave of Royal Defense troops jump-packed onto the roof of the palace and tried to breach to slay all opposition. While Ameris had the foresight to cause an HPG blackout, cutting communications off-world, the palace's alarm systems were sterner stuff. As first responders, the Black Watch Marine Infantry proceeded to assault the throne room. Their job was to secure the royal family, eliminate any threats, and get them away from danger, while the rest of the Black Watch powered up their equipment at nearby Fort Cameron. Cutting through the roof and throwing satchel charges, the Black Watch Marine Infantry assault teams almost killed Ameris right then, who did his best to hide and scream for reinforcements. Meanwhile, the 4th Ameris Dragoons commander had a problem. He needed to get his main forces to the palace in Unity City, where Ameris' bodyguard was desperately fighting against the Black Watch Marine Infantry. The main issue was that between his position and Ameris's was the Black Watch garrison, which was now on full alert. All Ameris would have to do is get his 4th Dragoons into the city in force, and his coup would be secure. All the Black Watch would have to do is fight like mad bastards until the SLDF reinforcements arrived. And in this outcome, the entire inner sphere held in the balance. Ameris had prepared his men extensively for this very moment. They had the initiative, training, and numbers. They had all the data required to make this happen. All they had to do was to defeat a depleted garrison just now waking up. This would, however, be easier said than done. The coup was not isolated to the palace alone. Ameris' men had set off explosives and fires throughout Unity City to wreak mass confusion among first responders. Ameris' troops had even the foresight to effect, as I said, a communications blackout before deploying a series of precision nuclear strikes on the Black Watch base as soon as the alert went up. With the nuclear strike wiping out most of Fort Cameron, remaining SLDF forces in the capital were down to just the Black Watch commander Hani Schmidt and her 8 mech warriors, who had just escaped destruction moments earlier by being on standby alert when things started to go to shit. Colonel Hani Schmidt was hard as nails, and she knew her forces were the only thing in the way to stop Ameris' 4th Dragoons from entering the city in full force. She decided to stop them for as long as humanly possible. She knew every second she held would be, potentially, to save the day. Every second she held might grant the Black Watch Marine Infantry time to kill Ameris, who they now had pinned down in the throne room. Every minute might give a chance to reverse the communications blackout and get an alert broadcast to the inner sphere at large. Every minute might give the royal family time to escape. So Hani Schmidt took her mech warriors into hell to buy time. And amazingly, for a time, she stopped the 4th Ameris Dragoons dead. No matter what Ameris' lead forces, with all of their preparation, training, advantage in numbers, and equipment threw at the Black Watch, they kept coming. They'd nuked their base, and still, some of them had survived. They then threw wave after wave of mechs, tanks, infantry, and aerospace assets, which all bore down on the Black Watch, and onward the Black Watch marched, crushing and burning and destroying everything the Dragoons could muster. Dutifully, they fought, repelling every attempt of Ameris' forces to break through. They knew they had to buy time. They knew no fear but a job undone. Outnumbered and fighting like mad bastards, two lances of the Black Watch held up the entire 4th Amaris Dragoons. And so began the final stand of the legendary Black Watch.
At Gorst Flats, with Puget Sound to one side and Forested Hills on the other, the Black Watch made their final stand, forcing the vastly superior numbers of the 4th Amaris Dragoons to engage them at essentially point-blank range. Desperately, the 4th Amaris Dragoons sent everything they had at them and watched in absolute horror as the Black Watch blew them away like dandelions. Wave after wave, some of the best Amaris had died to the Black Watch effortlessly, who cut them down with mechanical precision.
The Black Watch held the line, hoping to tie up the Amaris Dragoons long enough for loyal forces to regain control of Unity City or at least kill Amaris.
The 2nd Battalion of Amaris' 4th Dragoons were pushed into action and were nearly annihilated in an instant. Two of the very best companies the Rimworld Republic ever had were cut to pieces before they could respond or cry out. No matter what the Dragoons threw at them, the Black Watch refused to die. Every single attack was repulsed, often with no survivors save the Black Watch waiting somewhere out there in the dark. Amaris was by this time panicking. This wasn't going down like it should have. No one was supposed to be this hard to kill. Time was ticking down, and sooner or later SLDF reinforcements would arrive, potentially ending the coup. He saw all of his hard work, all of his family's hard work, his legacy slipping through his fingers. He urged his troops to do anything to stop the Black Watch. Desperate and running out of time, the 4th Amaris Dragoons lost so much goddamn equipment to the Black Watch that they had one desperate option left. The 4th Amaris Dragoons and their rushed reinforcements resorted to surrounding the Black Watch with sheer numbers, pinning them down with all the firepower they could muster, and continually throwing inordinate amounts of manpower at them to prevent them from moving, and then dropping a series of nuclear bombs on the whole lot, decimating their own forces in nuclear hellfire just to try to kill them, just to end the threat of the Black Watch. The last surviving footage of the battle shows the Black Watch commander and 4 remaining Black Watch mech warriors gunning down a Rimworld's archer as the double flash hit. Maris's own 4th Dragoons barely survived in time to save him from the Black Watch Marines trying to cut their way into the audience chamber and gut him like a pig. As most historians will say, the Black Watch was technically destroyed that day, except for a handful of the regiment that still escaped all of that and survived. Yes, the Black Watch is that hard to kill. Nukes are merely inconvenient. These crazy lads and lasses did not sulk for their dead comrades. They had work to do. They did not disappear as one might after a coup, no, they had a duty. From the irradiated rubble of Fort Cameron, deep from the bunkers beneath it, 5 members of the Black Watch survived.
Under Captain Elizabeth Hazen, they would escape the battlefield to form the Ghosts of the Black Watch as a guerrilla movement in order to carry the fight on for generations if need be. They vowed vengeance upon Amaris. They vowed vengeance upon his people, his armies, his administrators, and his cause. The Black Watch would haunt Amaris until he died.
And, well, some would suggest those who died in the nuclear attack were buying time for something far greater, trading their lives for the purpose of distraction. Rumors and later controversial evidence would indicate some of them escaped with an unknown number of House Cameron, disappearing far beyond the reach of Amaris. But I've covered that elsewhere.
All across the Inner Sphere, similar betrayals were playing out, with Rimworld's Republic forces suddenly decisively turning on the depleted, undermanned, and under-equipped SLDF garrisons. For many months, these garrisons had been emptied to reinforce Kerensky in the periphery. For many months, Rimworld's Republic forces had replaced their numbers, worming their way into defense systems and preparing for the day of betrayal.
Ameris had, at enormous cost to him and his Rimworld's Republic, amassed an army of over 450 regiments to hold the hegemony. This army had, for the past year, slowly wormed its way into the hegemony and prepared with extensive training for just this very moment, a coup designed to be a sledgehammer blow against the heart of Star League. Often enough, Rimworld's forces would use nuclear or biological weapons in a sneak attack to ensure that the regular SLDF units didn't have any chance of retaliating or warning other garrisons. Suddenly, Star League forces found themselves overwhelmed by an enemy that had worked alongside them long enough to know their weaknesses inside and out. Massive nuclear bombardment was the reward for anyone who resisted. If anyone was capable of resisting with sufficient force, Stefan Ameris began using the threat of killing the First Lord, who none save Ameris knew was already dead. Faced with their lord being possibly alive, some garrisons would lay their arms down out of loyalty or hope that the First Lord would somehow survive. Others surrendered that day, seeing Star League as a lost cause and laying their arms down to save their skins. Many more died at their stations till their last, screaming for help that would never arrive. A bare handful, though, escaped to fight and resist for years to come.
In a single day, Maris had achieved his objective. Near total Rimworld's Republic control of many core Terran hegemony systems. Throughout the hegemony, Rimworld's Republic military operations struck with perfect synchronization, occupying SDS platforms and planetary defense installations. Throughout the heart of Star League, SLDF forces were surprised and murdered at their posts. In a single day, the majority of the hegemony was occupied by the Rimworld's Republic and Stefan Ameris. The orchestrated communications blackout had enabled the Rimworld's Republic to strike with near total surprise, and many months of preparation made transition of power nearly clean.
Soon enough, the entire hegemony and core SLDF holdings would be under Ameris' thumb. One man now controlled two vast empires, and potentially the whole of the Inner Sphere as an usurper. He controlled, in theory, the banks, the FTL Communications First Circuit, the vast Star League bureaucracy, and the assets of two tremendous empires. However, there was one last piece of business to attend. The rest of the family Cameron.
You see, the Camerons were Star League. The Star League logo is their house seal, after all. For generations, they'd ruled it, run it, and for better or worse, held it together. Maris realized they were a threat and decided to sort them out in the traditional manner of an usurper. First, he gave them the chance of joining him, which some took after considering the alternatives. Regardless of what was promised or threatened, in the end, Maris was fucking crazy. Once the killing started, he just continued on killing until they were all gone. With the last of their bodies on the cold throne room floor, he sealed it, turning the seat of humanity's power into House Cameron's final tomb. Throughout all hegemony territory, vast efforts were soon underway to wipe out any relic of Cameron rule or Star League. This was to be a new empire after all, and the old ways had to be ground to dirt. Through this transition, the great houses of the Inner Sphere took a neutral tack. They were smart enough to realize that eventually all governments topple, and on occasion new blood comes at the expense of old blood. As well, the great houses of the Inner Sphere were eager to see how this all played out. After all, in their eyes, House Cameron had this coming. The House militaries individually didn't have the power to conquer Ameris, nor did they have the want to do so. Ameris had not conquered their holdings, after all. In addition, there was an unsolved issue. The Star League Defense Force was the single most expensive military-industrial investment in centuries, and while their assets in the hegemony were now captured or gone, the remainder of the SLDF were still fighting in the periphery at this time. It was soon clear that until the matter of the SLDF's ultimate loyalty was handled, Maris only really ruled as an usurper.
Until the SLDF was aligned to the rule of Stefan Ameris or disbanded, the permanency of the coup was still hanging in the air. The SLDF was waiting for news, having in the meantime conquered New Vandenberg and more or less gained an upper hand in the periphery. However, Kerensky sent news to the now deceased Richard Cameron, and he received no reply. This wasn't immediately a cause for panic. Kerensky knew Richard and he were on shaky ground at best. Kerensky knew the kid didn't favor him, regardless of why. And so, Kerensky waited. In January, news began to circulate about an HPG glitch in the hegemony, the first circuit of SL-ComNAT being seemingly crippled. While communications had been rerouted through secondary channels, the HPG traffic to the hegemony had not been restored. By late January, people began to notice in panic that no traffic from Terra was forthcoming. The hegemony's central bank defaulted by failing to authorize routine SLDF wage and upkeep payments. It is known that in the event of HPG malfunction, the Star League government would revert to courier-handled communications traffic. However, every Star League courier sent into the hegemony failed to ever report in again. General Kerensky smelled a rat. He began to send his own scout ships to bring back news. Any news. But it would be Amaris who would break the silence. Amaris would declare himself Emperor on 31 January 2767 in an open address to the Inner Sphere. He indicated he had usurped and replaced Richard Cameron, but left his ultimate fate unknown. It would take until February the 4th for it to reach New Vandenberg in Kerensky's ears. As self-proclaimed First Lord, Stefan Amaris' first official order was to try to get a hold on the SLDF and either gain their loyalty or keep them busy until he could neutralize them as a threat. After declaring Star League to be renamed the Amaris Empire, Amaris ordered as Emperor for General Kerensky to maintain pressure on the Torian Concordat breakaway region. He offered to make General Kerensky a very powerful man, offering to have Kerensky as his sword arm, to bring law and justice and order once more to humanity. Kerensky was no fool, for he had long suspected who Amaris was, and he realized what was going on. And so Kerensky made a choice that would change everything. Kerensky said no. Thus began the Amaris Civil War.
Gather with them all to die. hold the line. Though hopeless, we will try to defend our homes and families. As warriors, we will die.
I don't care what any of you think. Amaris is wearing a fucking bib, and you can't prove me wrong.